might as well begin. We're going to be working Dumasani right until the moment he gets on the bus today. Yeah. And back to New York. But I'll give a little break here at the beginning. My name is Jody Kretzmann, and along with Dumasani Kumalo, we're going to be doing a session that we've sort of chatted about doing during the week that centers on the media, since that is the way most of us get to know what it is we know and in fact don't know about most of our world. Both Dumasani and I have worked on the side of the business that produces the news. Dumasani, of course, was a journalist in South Africa before being sent into exile, and I want to leave him lots of time to talk about the way in which the press in South Africa, in what is clearly a police state, as we go into the third year of police state measures, how the press in South Africa has been controlled, and in fact how the South African government has controlled the world press. But we thought it might be fun to link the discussion of of the press in South Africa with some discussion of how the media work in the United States, with an aim toward making us all more informed consumers of what it is we get, and upping our skills at least a little bit in reading between the lines of the media, and picking and choosing to some degree. So I want to draw on my own experience as a reporter. I worked with Time Magazine for a while and wrote for a number of other journals. Both Dumasani and I still do an awful lot of freelancing. And I think both of us now work as much on the other side of the media, that is, on the side of the media where people are paid to manipulate the media, to make the media, in fact, reflect points of view, whether in a political campaign or in a movement such as Dumasani is involved in and provides leadership for sanctions on South Africa. Many more people, in fact, work on the side of the media that is aimed at manipulating the media these days than actually work for the media themselves. So I want to just start with a few very brief and I think simple-minded kinds of remarks about my own understanding of the media, and then turn it over to Dumasani. Seems to me that if we're going to think about our own role as consumers of the media, when you think about what the media do in society, there are two places to sort of focus on. Somewhere over on this side, we've got the real world. That is the world that we all live in 24 hours a day, where people from all kinds of different situations are always doing things, where there are always things happening, whether at Holden Village or any place else. And the mystery is, how is it that the media, in interacting with the real world, thousands and thousands of events every day, how is it that they pick out those things that they call news to get through to us, the consumers? In that process, in the mediating process, in the sitting in the middle and sifting process, then there are sort of two moments to pay attention to. One is this moment, that is, how do the media and the people working in the media as reporters and as other folks dealing with professional identities in the middle, how do they understand the real world? And what do they do in relationship to the real world to form news in particular? The other moment to look at, which we may want to talk about together, is the intersection then between the media, that is, once they have been produced, and all of us as consumers, right? So it's really a complete circle, obviously. We are both consumers and we are part of the real world. The media interpret for us the real world. We as consumers consume their interpretation of the real world, which then in turn turns us around and makes us act differently in the real world. So we've got a circle here, and I want to just think about an event on that circle, a series of events that help us define what it is that gets conveyed through the media. Let me say that my own perspective is that there are no conspiracies involved in the distortion of the news, but that there are lots of practices by the people in the middle, media professionals, which serve to narrow, shape, distort in some predictable ways, the way in which the real world comes through to us. And I just want to make a couple of notes for you about what we do as journalists that distorts the world. Dumasani's already, I think, referred to a number of things that I think are terrifically important to pay attention to. Obviously, blacks and other people of color are severely underrepresented in virtually all of the news media in the United States. And therefore, the kind of perspectives that come from people of color communities in the United States are themselves underrepresented. It's also true, I think, that that we need to recognize the kind of perspectives politically, ideologically, that determine what it is the news in the United States gets framed around. A friend of mine who deals sort of in global politics is fond of reminding us that in the United States, the political spectrum runs the whole gamut from A to B. And that, in fact, a huge amount of the political spectrum, which engages the rest of the globe, is not even a part of our accepted dialogue in the United States. And that kind of ideological framework, that tight box ideologically, really a conversation between, on a global scale, between the far right and the near right, in some ways, is what shapes the conversation within the United States. So that when we get perspectives from the third world, for instance, or from the second world, they are jarring perspectives because they're not a part of the ongoing kind of public and civic dialogue in the United States. So there are some sort of screens about who journalists are and what they think that we should keep in mind right from the beginning. Let me just say a couple other things about this moment, though, when the media people shape the real world for us to consume. What is news? What is news? You just think about that for just a second. Think about the world, the word, news, new. It means it's not old. It's not ordinary. There's a sense in which what is news can't be a continuation, can't be part of an ongoing, unfolding set of realities. Most of us, as we live our lives, live them as a sort of set of developments. There's some logic to it. We move from point to point in relationships. We develop in terms of what we think about the world. There's some continuity. News is, by definition, discontinuous. One picks out what is new and doesn't tie it to what goes before. Tied with that, news not only is new, but it's often needs to be an event. That is, not all of reality is made up of events. Lots of our reality is lived as relationship, is conversation, is the experience of community. It's not all event. That is, poverty is not news. Riots by poor people are. Poverty is a condition. But news people don't think poverty is news. Riots by poor people, an event that sort of focuses attention, maybe, on underlying conditions. That's news. News is also, and I've already referred to this a little bit, tends to be formulaic. That is, editors at newspapers and magazines and at TV stations have in the back of their heads certain categories by which they make sense of the world. And they are more likely to think that something coming across their desk is news if it fits one of those pre-existing categories, one of those pre-existing formulas. Think about a few of them and next time you read the paper, begin to look for the stories that sort of exemplify those categories, formulas, facts that fit into accepted patterns. For instance, on the global level, I think it's clear that most stories internationally in the United States press get run through the East-West conflict. That is, the world basically is about Moscow and Washington. It's not about the United States or the Northern Hemisphere and its relationship to the Southern Hemisphere. So that even news from the Southern Hemisphere, whether it's South Africa or Central America, gets filtered through East-West formulas. What's important is what it means for Moscow and Washington, not what it means for El Salvador, Nicaragua, or Namibia or South Africa. The South, in some ways, for the American news media, I'm saying, doesn't exist, the Southern Hemisphere.
because the formulas mean that we have to have our eyes on the east and west. Well, you don't have to go that far afield to think about the formulas. Think about the formula of individual heroism. That is, any time a set of facts comes across my desk as an editor that can be sort of formulated as an individual heroic set of acts, that's going to be front page stuff. That sells papers. It's part of the sort of American mythology. It's the heroic rescue from the mountain, or the somebody walking by a fire and going in to save a kid, or even a cat out of a tree. Anything that you can frame as an act of individual heroism is a sort of formula that the editors have in their head, and they're just, the minute you've got something like that, they will run it. Well, I think we could probably all think of the formulas that we continually run into as part of what goes on in the paper. What else is news? News is anything that can be personalized. There's something about the American news media, which I think is reflective of American individualism in the culture as a whole, that says that nothing is important that is a social movement, for instance, unless you can personalize that, so that feminism is not important, but Gloria Steinem, as a sort of representative of feminism, can be news, right? What the black community is up to in all of its variety is relatively un- or underreported, but Jesse Jackson, as a kind of personalization of black community perspectives, or at least one set of them, is news. So that there's a constant push on the part of the media to give it flesh and blood, to make it personal. My contention is that leaves out a whole lot of realities, and certainly narrows our way of thinking about them. Finally, news is, it seems to me, these are just some beginning thoughts about how news gets defined and distorted. News, for news people, partly is what the powerful people say news is, right? I mean, one of the platforms in political life, whether on the local or state or national level, one of the sort of ways in which politicians know they have made it is when their news conferences automatically get attended by the press, by the relevant press. Under a certain level in any municipal government, you can call a news conference and nobody will come. Over a certain level, the mayor certainly, and everybody will come. The same thing at the federal level. And no matter what it is the powerful people in those positions say, it is news. It is, by definition, news. Even if it's purely garbage, even if it's nothing but the report of what the president ate in the morning, it is, because the president reported it and the president's news secretary called the press conference, it is ipso facto news. Right? So you get a beginning of a way of powerful institutions forming the agendas of the news media. Let me now just say one more word about the play between powerful people and news media folks. And again, doing this partly to make us a little bit more aware of what it is we're reading when we read it. Most news organizations are organized by beats, a beat system, right? That is, all of the networks have their reporters on the Pentagon beat, or at the White House, or on Capitol Hill. All of your local papers have people at City Hall, people covering the police, people covering the courts, and so on. If you put yourself into the position of a journalist covering a beat, your major focus is first to develop good relationships with your major sources, and second, to protect those good relationships with your major sources. So that every journalist's first sort of self-interested position when we're thinking about what's news is, will I be able to talk to these people again tomorrow morning? If I can't, my editor is going to move me. I mean, I'm not going to stay here at the Pentagon if the generals don't talk to me tomorrow. I'm not going to stay here at the White House if the White House press secretary starts freezing me out. So that most journalists on beats are primarily concerned with reporting the news in a way that allows them to go back tomorrow and to maintain their good relationships with the institutions that they're dealing with. Think about that process, that dance that goes on between journalists and institutions, and you begin to see why it is so rare to find critical reporting, to find reporting that distances the journalism from the institutions that they're covering. Not a conspiracy, just part of the name of the game, the part of the way a journalist has to make his or her living. The same thing happens, I think, to an even more exaggerated respect when American journalists are in foreign countries, where their relationship with the American embassy and with U.S. officials in those countries is key not only to their being able to report the news, but they're in fact being able to stay in the country. So that the picture of reality that comes out of an El Salvador or a Honduras or a South Africa has to be, for the American journalist who wants to stay there, the picture of reality that at least is consonant with what the American embassy thinks about. So you begin to get a sense of why journalists often sound like they are extensions of the State Department or extensions of the Pentagon or certainly extensions of the White House. This dance continues. Finally, let me just say that it seems to be one other major way in which the news gets shaped and distorted, simply for institutional reasons, is the emphasis in the American media, which is not as clear when you get in lots of other parts of the world, on factual reporting, what is called factual reporting. And the myth in the American media, I think it's a myth of objectivity. Most of us in journalism school, I didn't go to that, but some people who go into journalism these days do.
I did.
You remember the inverted pyramid, Dumasani? The inverted pyramid is the classic form of the story, of a piece of reporting. What you do in the inverted pyramid is you try to pack in the first couple of paragraphs, in your lead paragraphs, who, what, when, where, and why, with not very much emphasis on the why. Get the facts up front. And the interpretation, or the placing into some sort of perspective, is stuff that is buried at the end of the story. What's important is the factual content in the first couple of paragraphs. Everybody gets trained that way as a journalist. And it is, in one way of thinking about journalism, a very understandable way of looking at the world. What does it leave out? It leaves out the sense of continuity. The sense that what it is you're looking at is part of an unfolding history. The final thing that I would say then is it seems to me that mostly, I've been talking about this moment over here, one of the things to think about in this moment as consumers of media is that mostly what the American media do to us as consumers is remove us from history, is to make us interact with events in the real world in a way that they have no context, in a way that says they are isolated events, in a way then that says there's not much way that we as citizens can affect reality, can step into history, can understand a process of change going on. We, in other words, I think, are being robbed of our capacity to be effective citizens and effective public actors by the way the media mediate between us and the real world. And I think that that's something to be deeply concerned about. Let me stop there.
Well, I think of one incident 2 days ago. Reporters cornered Reagan as he was going from one room to the next and asked him something about, what about Mike Dukakis? And Reagan made a comment, I don't talk about cripples. Yeah. And so there's a big story now in the paper about, is Michael Dukakis an emotional cripple? And you know, he had to go to his doctors to get all his medical reports. You can read it down the hall. I'm a news junkie, so I always go down the hall. And you know, just to show you how, I say that to show you how news are being manipulated. So Reagan knows that Bush is 20 points behind. So since they can't beat Dukakis on issues, they can sort of cast a cloud that Dukakis may be crazy. And you know, and the media goes for that. I mean, it's been front page on the papers down the hall just 2 days ago. The other thing that comes to mind is when Reagan came into power, and of course it was mourning in America and the poor were no longer involved and we no longer read about them. One school of journalism did a survey of all the reporters who cover the White House. All of them earn way beyond, at least the littlest amount of money anybody earned was $80,000 a year. Otherwise, the rest of them were earning over $100,000 a year. And, you know, so these folks who filter the news to you, who are the media experts, I mean, don't even see the poor, except maybe when they pass them in their limos or whatever. And, you know, and that has a terrific impact. What has this got to do with covering South Africa? Well, it has a lot to do with it, because it indicates to you what happens. And again, to give you, even in the church, I mean, all we did this week was report to each other, and you guys covered the story for how you shaved under the tree. I mean, that's what happens in newspapers, except that you shared it with other people. And, you know, and in order to understand how the media covers the story in South Africa, you have to see, like everything else, how the media covers black people in this country, to use an example, since it's covering black people in South Africa. You really don't hear about black people. Let me give you an exercise. Go around and ask people, your friends, if they like Jesse Jackson. They're all going to say, oh, we don't like Jesse Jackson. And try and probe deeper, why don't you like it? Now, there are a lot of reasons not to like Jesse Jackson. And, you know, I could give you some of them. And, you know, but probe deeper, why do people, I mean, what are the specific things you don't like Jesse Jackson? And, you know, they will give you things like, well, he's not qualified. But they never use that same phrase on Pat Robertson, who was also a preacher and not qualified. And, you know, but the point I'm trying to make is that my theory, and I think there's a lot of truth in this theory, is that essentially Americans don't see black people on the media. So your only images of black people are the Cosby family. And, you know, and the Cosby family is perfect. It's like us. You know, the kids smile and everybody's nice and you know, conflict is dealt with in a very nice way. They are not like the families in your congregation, right? And, you know, so the only guy who carries the bad news is Jesse Jackson. I mean, each time he appears, he talks about the poor, he talks about racism, he talks about all these things you don't like to hear, right? So in the end, you say, it's like, you know, why can't he be like the Cosby family? One of the things that blew people's minds at the Atlanta convention, and this was a masterstroke by Jackson. What he did, he brought his kids. Now, many people never thought of Jesse Jackson being a family man, right? He brought his kids, and these kids could have been white in any suburb. I mean, they are nice kids, they are very articulate, and they're educated, they're just like any other kids. And, you know, but for the first time, oh my God, he has a family. Oh my God, they articulate. And, you know, but the point I'm trying to say to you is that that's the way you cover. Now, hold that and take that to South Africa. Most of the time when you've heard about black people in South Africa, you've heard it from white people, right? Who talk about black people in South Africa. And, you know, whether they be members of your congregation, friends, or experts on the people go to South Africa, hey, black people are suffering. It's like, again, in New York, they did a story on the homeless, and, you know, the reporter who did the story had a home, and, you know, the people they interviewed had homes. I mean, here are these people sitting in nice homes, there's a fireplace going, and it's in the middle of winter, say, oh yeah, the homeless are freezing out there. I mean, we talked about them there. And what this does to our mind, it makes them less, that's why we want to give them pity. Homeless people don't ask for pity. And, you know, and we had a case, you might have seen it, of a young black woman in New York called Miss Brown, I've forgotten her first name now. And, you know, and who refused the pity. I mean, you know, and said, you know, I don't need your pity. And, you know, and of course Reagan misused it when he was in Moscow and sort of claimed, we are this hero who wants to stay in the streets without really understanding. But as people don't need, but you see what we tend to do, we tend to look for people who are acceptable to us, as e.g. the media, who can then filter the real world, which we don't want to recognize as real, we want it as consumers, you see? So we always need this middle person who can tell us about the real world, even though we are part of the real world. And you know, the other thing about, I studied journalism in this country 15 years ago and went back home. I went back home very discouraged. I mean, one of the most discouraging things is that newspapers here are very, very local. Very, very. You buy the Seattle Times, I mean, they don't even report the Mets, you know, my favorite team. I can't wait to go down the hill and buy a real newspaper. But you know, I mean, it's just an example. And you know, they are so local. And if they are a suburban paper, forget it. There's going to be more about sales at nice stores. They won't even mention the poor. If you think about your suburban paper, and then people say, I don't want to read those Chicago and New York papers. They have all the bad news because they tell you things you don't want to hear. So it's possible here to be news illiterate in the sense that you don't read anything. I mean, you don't, you know, I mean, even the preachers, you know, reporting the news is the same thing. The preacher comes and reports the good news of the gospel. If that preacher wants to stay with your congregation, he's not going to talk about the poor and what's happening out there, because they'll start saying, wow, what kind of a preacher is this one? You know, we need a real preacher, meaning we need one who won't tell us what we don't want to hear. And this is why each time I have talked about South Africa, people always come to me and say, or even wonder, how come I never heard about this? But think about it. You don't hear about what's happening in your town. I mean, you know, you don't think about it. You don't hear. You know, it's you take San Francisco. The only time you hear about gay people is when they have a parade, and we all think, oh my God, look at the funny costumes they wear. Or now that unfortunately gay people are dying of AIDS, and you know, so gay people have changed from being the parade people to be the AIDS people. I mean, even, and that's why they can't even get a handle on the heterosexual population dying of AIDS, because in our minds, it's stuck that AIDS will only kill gay people. And you know, because that's a, and unfortunately, you know, I always say in this country, you know, you can think and say the Soviet Union and the communist countries dish out propaganda, because that's what they tell you. And I think, true, there's a little bit of propaganda. But there is as much propaganda in the United States. You know why? If you watch the 7 o'clock news, the first 5 minutes is what Reagan administration or Carter administration or Nixon administration or whatever administration wants you to know. They want you to know. And the story is told from Washington. Have you ever thought about that? You take 3 TV sets, if you have 3 TV sets, and you know, and turn off the sound in others and watch one. It's the same picture, the same people coming and telling you the story. They want you to hear the story. And they manipulate that. CBS once tried once and started saying, well, we won't cover the story from Washington. Hell, there was a whole row. People got fired at CBS. I mean, they changed the news director and everybody, because they dared to say, rather than have the Secretary for Agriculture tell us, oh, you know, the family farm is falling apart, you know, oh, the farmers, go to the farmers. They can speak for themselves. The administration doesn't like that. You know why? Because if you start seeing these farmers talk for themselves, it's reflecting bad on the administration. People ask the basic question, what is the government doing about it? And if you start, what is the government doing about it, you're threatening Reagan's job. You think he's going to allow you to do that? And you know, so what they do is, and Jody, I told her I was going to come and say, I agree with you. The thing about reporters who are on the beat, if you're in the White House, you know, you better be nice. You know why, what's his name, is making a name for himself? Who's the guy on ABC? Seriously, have you ever said to yourself, why can't they switch the damn thing off? I mean, you know, it takes one switch. It could stop and you could hear the question, why? Because Reagan knows, has discovered, the media folks have said, and that is propaganda. They have sat down and said, usually when he walks over the helicopter, that's when they ask the tough questions. So what do? Turn on the helicopter.
That's right.
And you know, so that when he goes there, he can pretend he didn't hear. Even if he makes a goof, then they can come back with damage control and say, well, he really didn't hear what they were saying. That is propaganda. And if the Soviets were doing it, or if the Cubans were doing it, or anybody don't like it, say, look at all that propaganda. Here, this is what our president is saying. And you know, this is the news. And we tend to accept all this. South Africa is the same thing. White South Africans, I mean, deny it. I mean, an African guy who's worked with my brother came and lived with me. And you know, and I sometimes tape the news on TV. I mean, this is a wonderful man, and he's worked with my brother. And I showed him, and he said to me, this is communist propaganda. I said, hey, this is Dan Rather. You know, the guy's going to come here at 7. He's in New York. And you know, white South Africans think it's propaganda. You know, because they own, I worked for a newspaper, the largest newspaper in South Africa, called the Johannesburg Sunday Times. And you know what they used to do? They used to have a separate edition that's sold in Soweto. So the news on page 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, and the sports that shows black faces would be in what was known as the extra edition or the Soweto edition. So that's the news that sells. And the fun we used to have was, the drivers, in fact, used to have this fun that, you know, one Sunday they would deliver the extra in a white neighborhood. And when we come to work on Monday, the switchboard would be blocked by cars. I don't even want to read about black people. And you know, but it's because they don't want to hear about it. Why do you think each time you've seen South African government spokesperson on TV, they've all said things like you say, but you know, how could they lie like this? I mean, how could they say all this? And you know, or you say to yourself, but that's not what I had in Holden. You know, they in Holden they said something different. But when Nightline did those series, I mean, I think the best thing, in fact, is try and get those series for your church. You know, ABC TV, Nightline program, YouTube. They had one program where they had the split screen, where they had, I remember it was Desmond Tutu, and Botha was the minister, and some. And they would ask, these people on inside, ask them the same question. And it was like they were talking about different worlds altogether. And you know, because they deny it. And you know, they say, oh no, that couldn't be true. And you know, oh, I can't believe this happens. But the media fails miserably in its job, which is to report the news, because they try and package the news in any way. But if you're going to understand the media, think about your congregation. Everything we've done here is reported, except that what you've said and what I've said has not been written down. And in, and now, when you start thinking about it, now you've had reports here from black people, and you know, during Rainbow Week, and you say to yourself, I never knew that. And this doesn't happen in my congregation. So you see, your congregation is getting biased or incomplete or whatever adjective you like to use. The other thing I want to end up with, so we can have plenty of time for questions, is language. Language is very, very, very important. You don't realize how important language is. Well, you know, if they report on somebody they don't like, they always say, the radical Jody said at home. The reader automatically, without being told, if they say he's radical, watch out what he says. And if there's somebody they like, they say the moderate Jody said. That is a non-verbalized message to the reader, say, read this carefully. So language is very important. I'll give you another example. And I said this in another session. You see, the trouble with the United States or the people in this country is that you've had one government for 212 years. And I know you have Democrats and Republicans, but essentially it's the same thing. And you know, and I mean the same thing in the sense that if you don't like Reagan, you wait him out. Like I'm waiting him out. You know, I look at the calendar every morning. I can't wait for January 3rd. Let him go. And you know, but or you can vote them out, or you know, so you've essentially had one government. Yes, you don't like somebody, and you didn't like Nixon, you impeached him, And in a, but you, so when you go, your understanding of government, I don't care how progressive you are, your understanding of government is an institution that is always there since you've had one for 212 years, that gets reformed by being changed, or you change the people that come into it and what have you. So it's a one institution. Well, then you come to South Africa. They also have what they call a government. But that is not a government, because it only represents 15% of the population. And you know, so when we say in South Africa, we want to get rid of the government and put in a new order, Americans get crazy. How could you do that to a government? Why don't you reform it? You know, why don't you do some, maybe if you just change them, you know. Maybe instead of scrapping out the school system totally, let's have a few black kids come in, then it will be okay. And you know, and Reagan uses this. The reason I tell you this is Reagan uses it. Reagan has never called Nicaragua, the Nicaraguan government, a government. Think about it. Have you ever heard Reagan sit down and say the Nicaraguan government is doing that? No, he's called them a bunch of Sandinistas, the Sandinista regime, the communist regime. Because he hasn't used the word government. That's why you guys don't mind funding the Contras. You know, you can send the Marines tomorrow morning. And you know, because they are not a government. But when he says the South African government, when he first gave an interview to Walter Cronkite, said, well, that government has always been with us. And it was like, well, they might be bad. You know, it's just a few people who are bad. If you get rid of them, things could be bad. But that's a very, very important thing, because we get locked up into the language, into the way things are said. And that goes a long way into how we view the world. And you know, it's also, if you know, if a white reporter, and this was true, I had a story in South Africa just to tell you this. There's a town, and this still happens in South Africa today. There's a town where every morning police go out and arrest black boys who don't go to school. If you can't go to school because your parents can't afford it, you get arrested. I mean, they arrest 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds every morning. And they take them to the government offices where they build golf courses for white workers, or they clean white offices, and then of course at 2 o'clock they send them out back home. And you know, this arrest goes on every day. And you know, so one day we decided to do a story on it. The story that had my byline, my name, ran in the black paper. Of course, all black people knew this was happening. And you know, in order for the story to run in the white paper, they had to send a white reporter just to go check it. And you know, so that we can hear it better if a white person says it. And you know, but the same thing being said by a black person, no, it couldn't be true. You know, it couldn't be true. And you know, but it happens not only in South Africa, it happens here. So you know, this is how the media, they are very, very careful how they manipulate it to you. They're very careful how they tell you the story. And you know, if there's anything Jody could have said 1,000 times, you have to understand that the reporters who work in the White House have to be nice to the people in the White House. The people whose aim is to perpetuate the propaganda, just as the reporters who work in Moscow have to be nice to the Soviets, because if you are not, we will shut you out. And if you get shut out, if you can't interview Reagan and you're Dan Rather, forget it. When Dan Rather fought with George Bush, you remember in Iowa? The poor guy, there were people who were saying, fire. And you know what George Bush said? When he was asking Jenny, oh, we won't talk to CBS anymore. The business guys who run CBS said, get us another reporter, get us another Dan Rather. We want one who will be nice to George Bush and not ask the tough questions. So the news is very well, and the state knows that they can freeze you up. In South Africa, they don't give you a press card. The reason you don't read about stories in South Africa, it's not that there are no reporters there, they are there. But the government says, you dare write, it will throw you out. And the question becomes, do you choose to be thrown out for telling the truth, or do you sit there and not say anything? And just because if they did, you'll get thrown out. Anyway, why don't I keep quiet? And you know, let's just feel free to ask any questions and whatever. He's here to answer the tough ones. So
you know, just to take the other side, I've always heard that the people in the tours.
The fact, you see now, this is the success of the state. The fact that you think when Reagan gets asked a question on Iran 1,000 times, it's not because the reporters are disrespectful or they are harassing him or they are trying to get at the truth. Because these guys are not telling you the truth. And the reporters are in a fix. You see, when you're a reporter, you tend to know the entire story. For instance, take the story on Noriega. I believe, and I think it's beginning to come out, the reason they are, the Reagan administration is after Noriega, this is a preemptive strike. They have used the Contras to funnel drugs into this country, sell drugs to raise money for the Contras, just as they sold arms to the Ayatollah to raise money for the Contras. They were prepared to go to any lengths. Noriega was very key in the drug traffic trade. Now, you know, the thing about these evil things is that they tend to surface. Now they are about to surface. So what do? The state takes preemptive. Let's charge Noriega. Now that Noriega has been charged in Miami, whatever Noriega says, you no longer believe because you say, oh, this guy, you know, he's been charged. You know, why? How could he say that? But you see how they've manipulated it? But you know, if Reagan is not going to answer the questions, when do you get a chance to ask questions for Reagan? And these guys, look, in the olden days, they used to kill the messenger. So that's not, if you think he's being harassed, I'm sure there are a lot of people who throw plates at their TV screens. Why can't they shut up? Because we don't want to be reminded by that. And the TV owners are aware of that. What do? They know that if NBC asks the tough questions, you're going to flip over and watch ABC. And Nielsen is going to come and say, all the houses in New York are now into ABC. See, the news, people who own TV stations and news are in business. They are there to make money. So if you get too upset, why did Bill Moyers leave CBS? Because Bill Moyers did a story about hunger. Remember, the myth in this country is that when you say welfare to anybody, they immediately think it's poor black people or Hispanic people. Or there are 3 times as many whites on welfare as there are blacks or Hispanics. But you never hear that. The image you have of welfare, oh, those, Reagan ran on a line. And you know, he said he used the racist term. So I saw a black buck in Miami who changed food stamps to buy brandy and whatever. That's true, there are people who do that, but that's not everybody. But you see, when Bill Moyers went out and did the hunger special, he showed whites. The White House came up and was very angry about it, and everybody, because if you can be told, as Jesse Jackson said at the same, that most of the people who are hungry, most of the people who are starving and in the streets are young white women who are single mothers. A TV station in New York did that and just showed, forget the poor black people, they did a story on the whites in the streets of New York. It nearly caused a revolution. I mean, you know, people are saying, how could you do that? And you know, it couldn't be true. People had to go out and find addresses. Where can I really find this person to prove it? But it's because it serves us well if we believe all people who don't work are black, all people on food stamps are black. So because when we say let's cut the food stamps, people say, yeah, cut them. You know, those blacks don't work. But the tragedy is that, it's one of those things, you try and step on, it's like racism. You know, I always say, if people hate me because I'm black, you know, they have lost more. You have to generate hate in you first before you can use, so it destroys you more. It doesn't bother me, I'm never gonna be anything but black.
Just one other word on the question about President Reagan.
If you're up there, please speak up.
Who really is, I think, rightly called a great communicator. Mm. But what we mean, I think, when we say that about the president is that he is a wonderful communicator when he has a script and when he is in charge of the setting where the communication is taking place. It's clear that his strong point is not improvisation or responding to questions. And his media people understand that, which is one of the reasons why he has had half
half as few, less than 50%, the frequency of news conferences.
Less than 100.
Yeah, of any president in the century. So that the press, the Washington press, gets very little chance to get at President Reagan and to ask the questions. So you've got a dynamic there where the president doesn't come out to answer questions very often. You've got a very hungry Washington press corps, eager to get at him, and you've got media people at the White House who understand that portraying the press as a group of hungry wolves, of a pack of wolves really after the president, really does redound to the president's benefit in terms of his image, right?
Works.
So you've got this dynamic going on now with this White House, which is, I think, which doesn't really serve the public's right to know, but it's an interesting kind of dynamic, and the White House really is controlling it, I think, in lots of ways.
Yeah, and you know this the other thing which Reagan was a master is he realized that people didn't feel good. And you know, poor Jimmy Carter told the truth and said there was a malaise in this country. They ran him out. And you know, but he realized that people don't feel good. And his media people did research. People don't like to hear about racism. Even when you use the word racism, they don't like that. And you know, people, yes, they want to know they're the hungry people and they'll send their money when they get the letter in the mail and that type of thing. But they wanted to keep it that way. And Reagan has mastered that. Reagan is the good news president. I mean, Reagan is always nice, he cracks a joke and tells you, oh, the world is okay. The world could be falling apart. I mean, that's a guy you need when they drop the nuclear bomb. He's gonna make you smile when half the country's on flames. And you know, it's that kind of, he knows how to do that. And you know, he has mastered that. And I think that's why he's so popular. I mean, if Reagan ran the third term, nobody can stand against him. And you think why? Because, you know, we like him as he is. He's relaxed, he's a nice guy, he tells us the nice news. And, you know, it's another thing Reagan has done, I was telling the other class, think about it. When, if ever, have you ever seen Reagan appear on TV with a black person? Just think about it. He's never appeared on the same screen with a black person. His commercials had all white people. I mean, he doesn't do that. The only people of color he's appeared with are the Contras or the black leaders in Africa who like him. He's never even met behind closed doors with the head of the NAACP or the Urban League or whatever. He doesn't. Now, there are a lot of people who feel very good about that, very kind. Finally put those black people in their place. And then you see our kids being involved in racial incidents in schools, and you get torn up. Because these children who in campuses are beating up on black students were raised by parents who were involved in the civil rights struggle in the 60s. I mean, doesn't it torture you that you've never been racist, you walked for peace, you marched with Martin Luther King, you suddenly have a child, what happens? The child gets involved in some racist incident on campus. And you say, in my home, we never taught this child. And you get torn up as a parent. Why? Because if you the kids that are in the first year of university or two are 18, right? From the time they were 13, these kids have seen one leader, Reagan, who's never embraced black people. They've seen a leader who talked obviously about black people have protection, we have to reverse, you know, there are these set-asides that are for black people, you know, the Civil Rights Act. And these kids are growing up, they are 13, they watch TV, they hear what Reagan says, and what happens, unfortunately, they internalize that. When they get, I go to the APT schools, you know, where they pay 18, where you pay for your kids, you know, 13, 15,000. When they see black children there in those schools, they think those black kids there are there on quota systems. Now imagine what it does to a black, these black kids come there because, you know, they are A students and their parents are paying. And you know, if you look at any of the privileged schools, there's very little money that goes to financial assistance to black people. Because black people say, I send my kid to a private school, right? It's an Episcopalian prep school in Pennsylvania. And he has told me many times how he's had fights with kids who say, oh yeah, just because you're black and just because you're African, you must be. I work day and night. I travel all over the country trying to raise the $10,000 I have to pay every year. My job only pays me $400 a week. And you know, I go speak at schools to raise money to send. But here's a child who's there because I'm paying through the nose. But just because he's black, this is, and these kids who say that don't come from racist homes. They come from wonderful families. But you see, the image that the media conveys is, you know, these are, this is what's happening. It's really sad when you think about it. Yes, sir.
I'm relieved of any worry.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah. And you know, well, one thing I never talk about is that I was married to Winnie Mandela's sister. And you know, so I know Nelson Mandela very personally. And I talk to Winnie all the time. And you know, it's one thing that the South African government has realized is that, you see, because you see, South Africa poses a different problem to people here. The central thing in South Africa is race. So even though you may want to say, I don't want to hear anything about South Africa, unfortunately there's this race component which draws us in. Now what Pretoria tries and do is try and create a situation where blacks are fighting blacks. Yeah. Because that way it, you know, it absorbs you, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, those blacks, oh my God, they are killing each other. And you know, it's I always say in campuses, if you go to the library, go to the UCLA or Santa Cruz or whatever those schools, go to the library and check the number of people who've died on black violence. We keep track of them. There's less than 100. People who have died from the white government killing black people, we are now over 3,000. But people don't remember the blacks who have been killed by whites, because when whites kill blacks, it's law and order. And you know, we accept it. But everybody remembers the neck lacing, the thing that they'll show you, which is the most awful thing, where they put tires. And I don't in any way say that is good in any way. I mean, I personally don't believe in violence, but that's my own personal thing. And you know, how many people have been necklaced? 3. But if you went to your congregation and they said necklacing, it's like blacks are dying every day on necklacing. There were 3 people. 3 people who died in necklacing. 3. And you know, and you know, but you know, and Winnie's house, they, I believe they've always wanted to burn Mandela's house, because if you keep on saying let's free Mandela, when you're free, he has to go somewhere, right? So burn his home. And you know, and you know, and what they did is they got a group of kids to use as a cover. Now, if you read the story, they say, well, the kids were playing soccer, and one of the kids who hang around Mandela's home had a clash with those kids, and suddenly Mandela's house burns. I mean, and they wiped out the whole house. And you know, but it's again, it absolves people in this country. Now we can say, oh, look at that. You know, blacks just went out and burned their house, and you know, it's. You know, we but the thing is to always try and, you know, look, you don't have to go to South Africa. Remember the civil rights struggle? The FBI used to have a program called what, Contel, whatever, where they used to get people to go to civil rights rallies and start trouble who were black, so that we could say, well, you know, the blacks won their civil rights, but look at them. And you know, look at what's happening. I mean, I go to campuses and they always, the South African government has its own black people, and who started the White House, like Bishop Mokoena, if you haven't heard about him, you will. And you know, they started the White House, and I mean, I've reached a stage where if I've had universities that have said to me, we'll pay you $10,000. Come and debate this black South African president. I refuse it. I mean, I could use $10,000. I could use $5 for that matter. And you know, I refuse to do it, because you see, then white people sit back and say, look at those black people. You know, now look at that. They're fighting among each other. Because you know, for some people, they are always looking for a loophole to say, my God, it's not my problem. And you know, so if they don't have the guts like the others who say, it's not my problem anyway, they will sit back and say, where can I find a loophole? It's like when we used to say to companies, why don't you hire black people? They turn around to you and say, okay, you find me a qualified black person. We'll hire anybody. That's not the issue. The issue is the principle. If you have the principle that we will hire anybody who comes irrespective of race, that's all we're asking. We're not asking you to say, okay, you find me a black person. You probably, Somebody was saying, was it in one of the sessions? Says, I wish there were black people in my congregation or in the town where you come in who are like the theologians who have been here who gave all the speeches. I mean, I think she said it, she meant well. But the point is not that you should have black members in the church that are going to speak like me. If you make your church an open house of God, that's all that's needed. You don't even have to be in a town where there are black people. And I can walk into a church that is all white in Montana and feel at home. And they say to me, you know, we've never had a black person for 5 years. And I feel at home because that's an open house of God. I can go to a church, you know, where they even have two or three black people and say, my God, why don't they finish? Let me get out of here. And you know, so it's not the presence. You see, because if you are going to love black people because they are present, you are not going to love them when they are not. It's not a question of, you know, when you go back to your church and say, you know, I was at the multicultural thing, and, you know, they told us, the Lutheran church, so, oh my God, now, it means now we have to have black members. And that's really not the point. The point is to be an open house of God where anybody can come and worship.
We're running out of time.
Oh my God, I talk. I can always talk like that.
Let's
take the last one.
Okay, one last comment.
One last one.
Well, I'm ready for some good news.
There's plenty of good news.
It seems what you're presenting is very pessimistic because if the media is determining what is the news and the way they're reporting the real world to us is distorted because of their choosing what is news and how to report it and so on. And then the administration, on the other hand, is putting out propaganda for the media to report, then where is there any truth? Where do we find anything that is accurate reporting of news?
I think
I personally don't want to see the country as being that, and the media and our administration as being that pessimistic. I know there's truth in both of those.
Right.
But I don't want to generalize so that there is no place where we receive truth.
No, I think what you do is you ask questions. The only thing I ask of you is read the same media, but ask questions.
Sure.
Ask basic questions like, you know, like I can't think of an example that comes to mind. I mean,
one thing you could ask, one basic question is, what did the reporter do? If you read a story, ask yourself, what did the reporter do before writing this story? Often the answer is, he went to a press conference, right?
Yeah, and
who staged the press conference?
And they
read between the lines a little bit about what the actual business of the reporting is. I think that's one of the things you're saying.
And another thing is, you know, how many people here read a newspaper story to the end? Most people don't read a story to the end, right? You always read about the first 4 or 5 paragraphs, then you say, I more or less have it. Most of the time what happens is that because the negative, the event, as George was saying, is the thing that sells, they will start with the event. But the real facts to get a whole balanced story. Now, even though the reporter is not really propagandizing as such.